Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I sure hope you had a great weekend. Wonderful to have you with us today for Air Talk. Coming up later, if you're a veteran on this day, which we honor you for your service to the country, we're going to open up the phones for you to talk about what your military service meant in your life. And I mean, what effect it had on you, whether it helped give a direction that might have been lacking in your life earlier, whether the losses that you were experienced were deeply traumatic and been difficult in the years since your military service. Maybe you're someone who still is serving the country militarily. I'd like to hear your personal experiences shared with all of us on this Veterans Day. That's later this hour. But we begin with an extremely important U.S. Supreme Court case. The oral arguments are tomorrow. It involves the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, commonly called DACA. Tomorrow, the justices will hear arguments on whether President Trump can end the program, which the president attempted to do back in 2017, but was blocked in various court rulings around the country. Joining us, co-counsel on the DACA case, he's represented 11 DACA recipients who filed a lawsuit, Mark Rosenbaum of the pro bono law firm Public Counsel. Mr. Rosenbaum, good to have you with us today. We appreciate it. So what are the arguments that are going to be presented before the court tomorrow on behalf of DACA recipients?
Well, the principal argument goes to the manner by which President Trump sought to reverse the policy, not only of President Obama, but himself as recently as March of 2017, several months before he issued the order to attempt to end the program. He had vigorously supported it and told DACA recipients, 700,000 recipients, that they had nothing to worry about, that they were productive, and that they could rest easy. Of course, President Trump can change that policy, but the law is really clear, and it makes sense from transparency and accountability principles. The law is clear that if he's going to do it, he has to be very, very straightforward in terms of what the rationale is. He has to utilize reasoned decision-making to explain it, and he has to consider the cost. In this case, we've got, as I said, 700,000 recipients, their families, many American-born children, their communities. The estimates are that if DACA were to end, it would cost this country economically in 10 years something like $500 million. 8,000 teachers, doctors, lawyers, social workers are involved. The president did neither of those. He did not explain. He simply said that the courts were tying his hands, putting the responsibility on the judiciary and on the Supreme Court in particular. And he never considered to any degree what the costs would be. It's just a terribly important principle in our democracy that where decisions of this magnitude are made, the public understand who's responsible and what the reasons are.
When President Obama established the DACA program in 2012, which, just to refresh everyone's memory, this is for people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as kids, so they were not born here as automatic U.S. citizens. They were brought from elsewhere, but this is really the country that they know. They grew up in the United States. Did President Obama have to lay out all the rationale as here what the potential downside of DACA could be, here's what the economic, did that all have to be part of establishing the program?
It's a great question, and the answer is yes. And in fact, he did lay out the reasons. It was actually then acting the head of the Department of Homeland and Security, Janet Napolitano. And what Secretary Napolitano said was that these are very, very low priority individuals in terms of ICE enforcement, and that the immigration authorities don't have the capacity to come even close to enforcing the law against all individuals. That, as you said, these were individuals. The average age was around 7 years old when they came into this country. They've had to follow very strict rules in terms of being productive, not violating the law, not being national security threats. And they had to be productive in terms of their contributions to the community. Secretary Napolitano did lay out those sorts of reasons in classic form, saying this is just not a high priority enforcement. You compare that to what Acting Secretary Duke and then her successor, Kirstjen Nielsen, did. No explanation at all, not even a mention in terms of what the cost to these individuals, their families, and the country.
What I wondered, though, when it was established by President Obama, were the points that those who were hawks on illegal immigration were making, that DACA, though well-intentioned and you know, understanding that the children who were brought here, this was not their decision, it was their parents, but that it could have a negative effect on future illegal immigration, that there could be costs associated. Was that sort of argument that the immigration hawks put forward, did that have to be addressed by President Obama?
It was analyzed along many of the lines that you're talking about. And what was said was, look, there's just no way that we can enforce against all individuals because they were minors when they came in. The sorts of intent that you're referring to wasn't present with these individuals. They are in the country today. And there was a quid pro quo, and that was that the individuals would, in fact, come out. They would reveal their identities to the government so the government would know who they were and where they are, and that they would then produce in terms of the economy. So the explanation was given. It doesn't mean that those who oppose it can't continue to oppose it and, in fact, argue that a successor president or even President Obama could change his mind. But there was a thoroughness.
Okay.
Explaining the reasons.
Yeah, I just wanted to get at whether it was sort of came at both sides. Mark Rosenbaum, co-counsel on the DACA case, is representing 11 DACA recipients who filed a lawsuit against President Trump's efforts to do away with the DACA program. He is with the pro bono law firm Public Counsel, where he directs the opportunity under law area of practice. Also with us from South Texas College of Law in Houston, Josh Blackman, associate professor. Professor, thank you for being with us again. One of the arguments here is that President Obama didn't have the authority in the beginning to establish DACA. What do you think?
Well, thank you for having me on. I filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, on behalf of the Cato Institute, and we took a somewhat unique position. We argued that DACA was a good policy and that the Dreamers should be protected, but that the immigration laws we have don't authorize DACA. So one of the arguments the court will consider tomorrow is whether President Obama had the authority to enact DACA in the first place. If the immigration laws didn't support this broad authorization of what's called deferred action, then President Trump is fully justified in suspending the program.
I mean, it seems just in terms of its effect, one of the biggest things a president could do in an executive action is creating DACA because of the hundreds of thousands, I think we heard from Mark Rosenbaum, around 700,000 DACA recipients. So the scope of this is huge. Does that factor in at all on a president having the ability to do this?
Right. Let's keep in mind that DACA has several components. One component is that it defers deportation, as we will not remove a person. I think most people agree the president can defer deportations because there's only so many resources to remove people in the United States. But DACA does far more than just defer deportations. It also grants work authorization to up to 700,000 individuals. And I think this is where the rubber meets the road. It's the work authorization and granting of other benefits, I think, that takes DACA beyond the scope of the immigration laws. It's not just about deferring deportations. And so I think there was a serious question over whether President Obama could do this. At least one federal court of appeals held he couldn't enact a similar policy. And then the attorney general reached the conclusion that we can't maintain this policy going forward. And that might be the grounds on which the court upholds the decision to wind down DACA.
And as you look at the composition of the court today, do the usual ideological lines apply here? Or because we're talking about the specific issue of a president's authority, could you see unlikely alliances when it comes to a ruling?
A few observations. All of the lower courts ruled against President Trump, and there was no split of the courts. The Supreme Court granted review. generally when the Supreme Court grants review, it grants review to reverse the lower court. So I think President Trump will prevail. It's possible we might get a very narrow ruling, maybe even 7-2, which takes a somewhat unique position. The court will say, well, we don't have to decide if DACA is legal or not, but we do know that President Trump can rescind it, and it's not subject to the review of the courts. In theory, that sort of ruling would allow President Elizabeth Warren in 6 months to simply, you know, reinstitute the policy. And that's a decision that could even get 7 or maybe even 8 votes at the court. So that might be one way to avoid the sort of sticky ruling of saying that the policy is illegal, if we say the courts have no role in this.
What would that mean as a practical matter for DACA recipients?
Yeah, million-dollar question. Or maybe half-billion-dollar question, I suppose. We have an election coming up in November. The Supreme Court will decide at the end of June. The president's decision to wind down the policy had a six-month period in it. So in theory, if the election turns the other way, the next president could just cancel the rescission and leave it in place. Or perhaps, against all hopes, maybe Congress can get off its butt and enact some more permanent legislation to give the Dreamers something they can rely on rather than this fleeting executive action that can be suspended from year to year.
We're talking with South Texas College of Law Professor Josh Blackman joining us on Air Talk. We're at 866-893-KPCC if you have a question, or you can ask it via the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Let me go back to Mark Rosenbaum, who's co-counsel in the case with public counsel. Your thoughts about Professor Blackman as sort of a way forward for the justices. What do you think?
Well, let me make a couple points if I can. And I also want to make clear, I'm representing these young people along with Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, a law firm, and Luis Cortez, who's an attorney himself, a DACA recipient. I think that the argument that's being presented by the professor really doesn't square with how the Trump administration and particularly this court has looked at the executive authority. It's pretty clear. You think about the Muslim ban case. You think about recent positions that the Trump administration has taken with respect to all sorts of immigration matters, that the recognition is that the president, the executive, has a great deal of authority when it comes to national security, when it comes to immigration, and when it comes to prosecutorial discretion. What President Obama said here was that, look, we don't think it makes sense to say to individuals whom we don't have any realistic possibility of enforcing the law against, and whom it doesn't make sense to prosecute because of the circumstances of their entering the country and because of the specific conditions that we're putting on their being in the country in terms of working, hiring individuals, being at school, contributing their community. I represent doctors, lawyers, teachers, social workers in this case. And as far as the work authorization is concerned, Congress has specifically said that the president has the authority as part of his executive actions when they come into humanitarian goals. And it's really important to recognize there's nothing new about what President Obama did and what President Trump did for the first several months of his administration. Presidents going all the way back to the Eisenhower administration have, in matters of crisis, national security, humanitarian claims, have exercised this sort of deferred action. Doesn't give an individual citizenship, doesn't say you can stay here forever. It simply says we don't regard you as a prosecutorial priority at this time.
But, of course, the humanitarian piece of that, that's in the eyes of the beholder. Josh Blackman, back to you on that and what we heard Mark Rosenbaum saying, Congress authorized the president under humanitarian measures to do things like work authorization.
The million-dollar question here is, what did Congress in fact authorize? And my friend and I read the statutes quite differently. The statutes here are quite open-ended. There's no actual statute that says you can grant deferred action. This is an executive practice that's been cobbled together over the decades, as it suggested. And since 1996, when the current law was enacted, deferred action has only been used in a fairly narrow set of circumstances. That is, where a person has status waiting for him or her at some foreseeable point in the future. The entire purpose of DACA is that people have no prospect of gaining status unless something else changes. And that's why I think that this policy, though laudatory, goes beyond the scope of delegated authority. And I think this builds into a broader argument about whether a court should defer to broader exertions of executive power, or whether courts should defer when the executive tries to find authority in statutes that simply doesn't exist. Although I think this, it's unlikely the court reaches this. I think we're more likely to get a ruling on fairly narrow, just what's called a grant on whether the courts can review these policies.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us and setting the table for tomorrow's arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program known as DACA. That's Josh Blackman, South Texas College of Law, Houston. Mark Rosenbaum of Public Counsel, co-counsel in the DACA case being heard at the High Court tomorrow. And of course, tomorrow we'll have a reporter on who listens to those arguments and can characterize what the justice has had to say and the questions they asked. Coming up, we open up the phones for veterans in our audience to share what their military service has meant to them. I'd like to hear from you if you were a veteran or currently serving in the military. 866-893-KPECC. We're going to go straight to veterans' calls. I'd like you to be there at the top of the list. 866-893-5722 as we honor Veterans Day. Back in 1 minute.